A history of comedy. It's Seven Old Jacks. A history of comedy.
Come and have a rummage in the archive.
A history of comedy. It's Seven Old Jacks. A history of comedy.
Come and have a rummage in the archive.
Hello and welcome to A History of Comedy in Several Objects, a podcast brought to you by the University of Kent about the British Stand-Up Comedy Archive. The British Stand-Up Comedy Archive exists to collect, preserve and make accessible material relating to stand-up comedy. In this podcast, we take one object from the collections per episode and discuss it to find out what it can tell us about the history and form of stand-up comedy.
I'm Ollie Double. This is Elspeth Miller, and we are very much the Hubert and Hilary Haddock of comedy archiving.
Oh, I don't know who they are, I'm afraid.
Do you know what? I'm so excited about this one. Right, so Hubert and Hilary Haddock was an act in the 1980s alternative cabaret scene, and it was a male-female double act, and Phil Herbert was the man, and I forget the woman's name right now, but Phil Herbert also did Randolph the Remarkable, an act which involved putting his tummy into a washing-up bowl, which I think we might have mentioned in a previous episode. And he was also got a modicum of fame in the sort of late 80s, I think. He was on Julian Clary's Sticky Moments as Hugh Jelly.
Was he character. In the Pranksters book?
Yeah.
Did I pick Randolph the Remarkable as the Maybe. Person I wanted to see?
I think you might.
Maybe.
I think you might. I never saw him live, so I'd love to see him. But this was a different act. Hubert and Hilary Haddock was their act was the Fish and Fire Fantasy. So it was a kind of mad juggling act with actual fish, like from a fish market, a fishmonger, right? Apparently it went down very badly at the Earth Exchange, a vegetarian restaurant. And also somebody told me recently a thing about somebody heckling, demanding variety at a show in, I think, the Comedy Store. And Hubert Haddock, a.k.a. Phil Herbert, smacked him round the head with a fish.
Oh.
Yeah. So a classic double act to start the episode. But of course, this episode has nothing to do with that, right? Okay. So what is it we're looking at this episode?
We are looking at a poster, some posters for Cabaret Go-Go, which was a cabaret, alternative cabaret club set up in Newcastle.
In Newcastle, in the northeast of England. And so we won't talk too much about these posters right now because they were, we talked a lot about them. But basically, I went to meet Ray Campbell, who is a donor for the British Stand-Up Comedy Archive.
Yeah, so when we had our year of kind of funding, basically, for the archive, where we employed, I was employed as the project archivist, and my colleague Erin was employed as a digitisation assistant. We were really actively going out and contacting people, comedians, and people in the comedy industry. And it was in that year that I contacted Ray about whether he'd be interested in depositing material with us, and I can't remember now who gave me his name, but thanks, whoever you are. I'll have it on email. It was a comedian an ex-comedian. So Ray deposited material mainly relating to kind of Cabaret Go-Go and a few other clubs that he kind of co-ran, as well as some material relating to his kind of career as a comedian.
This says the Fun Committee Presents. He was one of the people who organised Cabaret Go-Go. But we won't say too much about it because, as I say, we've got a big interview with him, which will make up most of the episode. I will just tell you that I interviewed him at, I think it's called the Swedenborg Hall in London. I was there for, I was doing a talk for the Society for Theatre Research about alternative comedy based on materials in the archive, but Ray introduced me on that night. I invited him to do that, and we, before the talk, we sat in the hall. So you'll hear it's a very lively acoustic. It's very echoey, the interview. But I took scans of the posters rather than the original. I didn't want to damage the originals. And we talk about each of the posters at some length. But I suppose it's just worth saying for listeners, okay, why is it worth listening to a podcast about posters? And the answer is because it's a really interesting reflection on how alternative comedy / alternative cabaret developed outside of London, you know, the provincial scene. But the first thing I did when I met Ray was to ask him about the first time we met.
Edit.
So, Ray, when did we first meet, do you think?
It was probably, and I was thinking about this a couple of days ago, it's probably 1988 or 1989. I'm kind of inclined to say 1989, sort of maybe the beginning of that year. I couldn't tell you which month, to be perfectly honest with you. It's probably on one of the posters. In fact, I actually remember the poster.
Okey-doke.
Edit.
But so, Elspeth, but he's not, you know, he wasn't known as Ray Campbell, which is his actual name. He wasn't known as that on stage.
No, he had a number of stage names, didn't he? But yeah. The main one he used was Buddy Hell.
Right, so we talked, when I spoke to him, we talked a little bit about his stage name, and we can hear that right now.
Edit.
You used to be known as
Buddy
Hell.
That's right, yes.
A great stage name.
Yes, a very post-punk stage name too.
Yeah, because that's the thing, isn't it? That you used to be a lot of people on the cabaret circuit, or the comedy circuit, that had clearly false names.
Yeah.
That were kind of almost like anti-stage names. So
yeah.
Mark My Words or Mark Soda, Maria Callas, that was quite a good one.
Oh, wonderful name.
Yeah, and of course that was the same in punk, because you had Johnny Rotten, Sid Vicious,
yeah.
Joe Strummer and so on.
Edit!
So yeah, we've found out how I met him, we found out about his stage name, and now we're going to hear the main section of the interview. It's about half an hour. And in the interview, basically, we talk about the posters, and I think we go into lots of interesting details about things like graphic design and the nature of the club. We've got a bunch of posters for Cabaret Agogo. So for the benefit of the listener, what was Cabaret Agogo?
Well, Cabaret Agogo was the very first alternative cabaret club or cabaret club in Newcastle. When I moved to Newcastle back in 1986 to become an undergraduate at Newcastle Polytechnic, I used to ask myself, where were these alternative comedy clubs? Where were these cabaret clubs that I had seen in London that I had actually been to? And I thought, well, after the Newcastle Fringe Festival of 1987, I think it was, or 86, I can't remember which year it was, there was a fringe club at the Live Theatre. And I remember sitting there in the audience thinking, what a wonderful room this is, and wouldn't it be great if we could have a club like this? So one day, I walked into the, what's the name of the pub now? The Barley Mow, which is across from Keelman's Hospital. It's no longer there, sadly. And I bumped into Clive Little, who was drinking a pint of beer, and I said, oh, you're on my course, aren't you? Hey, yeah. And we got chatting, and I said, well, what do you think about starting an alternative cabaret club in Newcastle? And he was well up for it. He was really quite enthusiastic. So I think either that same evening or perhaps the evening afterwards, we had two pubs in mind, and we went to each of them. One was the Bridge Hotel, which I'd been to see local folk bands. And it had a big cellar, and we went down to see that, and we thought, maybe not, because there are too many pillars, and that ruined the sight lines. So we went to the Broken Doll, which is another music pub that I'd been to, drinking Slalom D, which is a super strong lager. But anyway, that's by the by. So we went up, we had a look at the room. The room seated about, I don't know, maybe 50 people, and we took it. We just said, this is the room for us. So we started in December 1987. The date, I can't remember off the top of my head. It's probably on one of those posters, actually.
Well, do you want to have a look? Because I've got printouts of the posters.
Okay. That's the one. So it was the 4th of December, 1987, when we set up the first Cabaret Agogo. We weren't sure if we were going to get an audience, and I'm looking at this poster now. £1.50, £1 concessions. Comedy, clowning, music and mayhem plus open spot.
And also, I mean, in terms of the design, I mean, and I mean, we were sort of talking about radical art movements, but I mean, there's a look of photomontage. There's, you can see the stamp of John Hartfield, the pioneer of photomontage there in a way.
Yes.
And also, you know, Dada, there's certainly a kind of Dada look. And punk, of course, as well, as you said. But I mean, punk, in a way, got some of its influences from those radical art movements through some of the people having been to art school and
yes.
so on. And it's a great looking poster. There's a kind of square looking guy. I don't know, sort of very well. I mean, formal collar and tie and a suit, brill creamed back hair, looking quite severely to one side. And over him, there's a cutout from a newspaper lettering saying, "I didn't say honest." And it says true life stories. And then there's another guy, a sort of profile in a hat, probably a trilby, a grey trilby or something.
Yeah.
And it has a very homemade feeling in the best possible use of that phrase.
Yes.
So was there a lot of thought that went behind the look of the poster?
Well, I'm guessing there was, because I didn't actually design this poster. Bass Jansen designed it. And the person there with the brill-creamed hair is actually Ronald Reagan, as a young man.
Absolutely. I recognise him now.
And that would have been taken probably in his more liberal days.
Right. So, before he veered over to the right.
Exactly. He was a sports announcer, I think. That's how he began in the world of show business. And then he moved into acting. But, yeah, he was a Hollywood liberal. In fact, I think in Gil Scott-Heron's B-movie, he's mentioned, you know, the Hollywood liberal who changed to become this this General Franco when he became governor of California. But yes, the strap lines, I didn't stay honest, stranger than fiction, true life stories. Some of these straps actually found their way into other posters. They were recycled.
Right.
These were constant themes that were going on.
But in case anybody thought it was too po-faced and serious, it does say The Fun Committee Presents.
Yes.
And of course Cabaret Agogo is quite a fun, and it's almost like a consciously retro name, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like a Vegas kind of twang to it.
Oh, for sure, yeah. And The Fun Committee, we called ourselves that. That was the name that I gave the group of us. And Cabaret Agogo, actually, the name itself came from a guy called Miles Danso, who wasn't actually formally part of the group. We were a bit like a band, actually, which is the funny thing about it. But, yeah.
So who were the other members? You mentioned bass.
Yeah, there was Clive Little. He was a musician whose stage name was Evil C. He used to play guitar, sing a couple of songs. And he did this Indian shirt trick that he got from either Arnold Kunzler Burt or Marcel Steiner. I think Marcel Steiner was the one who actually performed it first. The other person involved in that in Cabaret Agogo was Martine Delard, who was Clive's girlfriend at the time. So including myself and Bass and Clive and Martine, that was four of us.
And Martine had a comedy musical act, I think.
Yeah, she was in a poetry collective called the Small Tits.
Small Tits, wasn't the catchphrase "We never had bras to burn"?
That's right. Yes,
which is a funny joke.
Yes.
Great. I mean, and it started at 7:30, which is actually quite an early start time for a cabaret.
Well, you have to remember, back in 1987. The pub shut at 10:30 every night in Newcastle. So even on Christmas Eve, you'd find that the pubs were shut in the evenings. And so, yeah, if you wanted to drink after the pub shut, you had to go to a club like the Tuxedo Princess, which was just abominable, really.
So that's the first one, and we've got a bunch more posters here. Maybe we should just talk about each of them as they come up.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, there's one here from, I'm guessing this is 1989, and it's one that I designed. It still uses the same masthead, Cabaret Gogo, at the Live Theatre, Broad Chair, Quayside. The headline act is Mickey Hutton, who I've described as a sharp comic. Wireless, live wire comedy. Now, Wireless, they were a sketch team. And Paul Sneddon, who is Vladimir McTavish, was part of a collective of four. And I think at this point in time, it was just him and Jez Casey.
Okay.
So they'd been reduced to two. And they used to run a monthly show at the Red House on the Quayside. And I suppose they were the forerunners of alternative comedy in Newcastle.
So there was a little scene. I mean, there were you guys in the fun committee, but there were also other people around, Mickey Hutton, these guys from Wireless.
Yeah.
And then as it grew, presumably other people came along. And
yeah. So we kind of found out, you know, they'd sort of come to us and we'd, you know, give them an open spot to see how they went.
Anvil Enterprises, was that Anvil Springsteen?
That was Anvil Springsteen. After he'd went solo, because he was part of a street act called the Human Anvil.
And he used to get people to break paving slabs over his chest or something?
That's right, yes. And his brother was the other half of that act who'd wield the sledgehammer. Well, he left, and his role was taken by Graham Kennedy, and I was in a double act with him for a short time as well.
And then you've got the Plain Truths.
Yeah, the Plain Truths were I think they were a jazz band. I mean, yeah, there's a little saxophone that I drew there.
It's a nice bit of graphic design. Because we should just say about the graphic design, because one of the things we really enjoy on this podcast is the way that people have designed leaflets, especially at this time, because there was no computer design at that point. You couldn't make something look super professional. So what you did was you made it look personal and homemade and accentuated that. The basic layout here is like an old variety poster because it's a series of blocky lettering in different boxes with a phrase under each act's name.
Yeah.
But as opposed to that, which would have been typeset with wood blocks by expert, you know, craftspeople at the, you know, whoever, Moss Empires or whatever, this is handwritten, right?
Yes.
So you've got a felt tip out or something.
That's right, yeah. I used a felt tip pen and I went over some of these letters several times.
So the S on Plain Truths is written with a rotring or something and it's drawn to be the S, but it's shaped like a saxophone.
That's right, yeah. This poster was in fact influenced by Cast a New Variety or the Hackney Empire because I'd done my work placement at the Hackney Empire in 1989.
Amazing.
Yeah.
There we go, because obviously the Hackney Empire was a variety theatre in the classic era, closed down in the 50s, became a TV studio and then a bingo hall, which it was for many years, and then Cast revived it as a theatre.
Yes.
In, 87 or something?
1986, I think
it
was.
Yeah, because December, wasn't it, the first show?
That's right, yeah. And it was their 80th anniversary of the Hackney Empire opening.
Ah, amazing.
Yeah.
So that's... Oh, and then there's Simply Fab Jez.
Yeah, Jez. Now, Jez was Graham's fellow student at Newcastle Poly, and he was a filmmaker.
Okay.
And he tried his hand at a bit of stand-up, so we put him on the bill. And, of course, you know, at the Live Theatre, the prices have gone up as well.
Yeah.
Because...
Extortionate. £3, for goodness sake.
I know, we really robbed them.
But for members, got in for £2, you know, it's definitely worth joining, right? Yeah. I also like this, plus jugglers, dancers, disco, and wonderfully delicious but cheap food from Red Herring. Oh, it sounds like a great night.
Yes, the Red Herring was a vegetarian restaurant that sponsored some of our shows. Right. They were quite supportive of us.
That's good. Should we move on to the next one?
Yeah, sure. So, we've got a poster here called Alternative Seaside Special. This is one of my ideas. I was obsessed with television variety. Well, I was obsessed with the idea of satirizing television variety. Right. And on this, we've got Les Bogrell. That's me. That was one of my alter egos.
I think Bloody Hell is probably better.
It probably is. But this character predates Bernard Wrighton.
Oh, and it was like a satire of those old sort of right-wing club comics.
Yeah, Les Bogrell, I mean, his line was he's a crap comic, basically.
Yeah.
And he was a kind of a composite of Bernard Manning, Colin Crompton, and maybe a little bit of Les Dawson.
Oh, there we
thrown
go.
In. Yeah.
What about Johnny London? Who was that?
Johnny London was a Geordie poet who played guitar. He was actually on the very first bill on the 4th of December, 1987. And I was, like, adamant that we should have him on the bill.
Yeah.
So we got him to play for us. I'd actually designed the set. Well, it was a kind of a set. What I did was a little bit of impromptu art. I took a beer tray and I put a little bit of builder sand that I'd nicked from down the road, a couple of cocktail umbrellas, and I'd scattered loads of detritus over this to replicate one of our really awful beaches.
And it's got that brilliant look of trying to be cheerful in the graphic design, but big, super homemade and amateurish, again, in the best sense of the word. And I like the fact, the irony of taking this slightly sort of old-fashioned type of entertainment and sort of doing it in an ironic style is highlighted by the fact you've got bingo! Exclamation mark, knobbly knees contest! Exclamation mark, prizes! Exclamation mark, mystery guests, and so on. And you're still at the broken doll at this point. The prices are $250 and $150 by this point, but you are starting later at 8 o'clock.
Yeah,
and supported by Northern Arts. Now, people often think of stand-up as being something that's never really benefited from public subsidy, but you did get some public subsidy.
Yes, that's right. We got public subsidy mainly from Northern Arts for poets, and Johnny London squeaked in as a poet.
So interesting. So you kind of gamed the system. They wouldn't do comedy, but they would do poetry. So you go, well, we've got poets.
Exactly, exactly.
How interesting.
And I think it was Nick Tarchuk that planted the idea in our heads.
Because Nick was doing comedy in sort of Leeds and Bradford.
That's
and
right,
those
yeah.
kind of places.
Yeah.
And various other little towns, actually, around there mm-hmm. that he did over the years. And he was a poet, a performance poet.
That's right. We had him up a couple of times.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So should we have a look at the next one?
Yep, okay. This is First Wave Club. Now, this is another poster designed by me, mostly.
So how did First Wave Club relate to Cabaret Agogo? Because it says on there, a Cabaret Agogo production.
Well, the First Wave Festival was an arts festival that was spearheaded by the Newcastle Arts Centre. And they asked us to put on the Fringe Club there.
Right.
And this is what we came up with, basically. A series of four shows, starting with, if you look at this box here,
on 12th
of July. That was Hogwash Theatre Company. Don't remember anything about them.
I do.
Oh, do you?
They were from Sheffield, I knew
them. Oh, right, okay.
Feminist Theatre Company.
Oh, right.
With an emphasis on comedy and singing as well.
Yes. So it shows you the variety of performers that we had on. Brendan Cleary was a poet from Northern Ireland. I always remember one line from one of his poems, which was, "Newcastle is Benidorm." Where's the motorway? Andrew Glover was a local comedian. We used him a few times, and then he came out with a racist line, and then we didn't book him anymore.
Yeah.
The Light Program, I have a sneaking suspicion they were a band.
Yeah.
Suitcase Circus, of course.
That's 13th of July, so the next day.
Yep. So Suitcase Circus, I think, were based in... I can't remember where they were based.
Somewhere in Yorkshire, I think. I think it was one guy, wasn't it?
That's right. I think it was a guy called Pete White.
Pete White, it was.
That's right, yeah. The Big Fun Club, who were fellow students. They were a year above us, in fact.
Double act?
They were... At this stage, yeah, they were a double act, yeah. Trio de Twang, another jazz band. The Small Tits, who we mentioned earlier. Hufty, 14th of July. She was on The Word.
Right.
Channel 4's The Word.
So The Word, which was a kind of notorious youth programme fronted by Terry Christian and various other people.
That's right.
Bart Lamar was on it at one point.
Yeah.
But Hufty was a kind of a young lesbian comedian who looked quite punk, right? She had like a Mohican and stuff.
That's right, yeah.
And a strong kind of Geordie accent.
I mean,
there was almost like a hint of Viz about her, Viz comic.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, she used to do gigs for us. She more or less did the same stuff. She never changed her material. I don't know what she's doing now. But anyway,
she was quite well known for a short period of time.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. But I think she was involved in some kind of feminist theatre company as well. Bloody Women, now they were a theatre company. GLAAD were a gay and lesbian band.
Oh, brilliant.
And then you had the Poetry Virgins, who I don't remember an awful lot about them.
But good programme for them, because you might get some subsidy.
Yes, exactly.
And 15th of July, the final.
Yes, so Muhammad Yusuf, again, a poet.
Right.
Buddy Hell, that's me.
Amazing comedian.
Yes. In those days, probably doing material about flies and other insects.
Okay.
Evil Sea, that's Clive, and Bushmen Don't Surf, again, a band.
So, and that was Newcastle Arts Centre.
Yeah.
And again, a very homemade-looking thing. Did you say you drew this one?
I drew this one as well.
And on Hogwash, you've got the logo, which presumably you copied from there, because there's a pig on...
That's right.
It looks like you've actually literally copied what their logo looked like, but it's a hand-drawn version. Yeah, it's a nice piece of work, that.
Great. So let's move on. Hey!
Oh, here we go.
So... June 29th, a Thursday, probably 1988 or 1987.
I reckon it was 88.
It was probably 88, actually. Again, supported by Northern Art, so you had GLAAD on the same bill as the Red Grape Performance Collective.
Yes, indeed. And the Red Grape Cabaret Performance Collective was something I set up. So it was a bit... This is what I find fascinating, is that in different towns and cities around the country, alternative comedy... It largely come from London.
Yeah.
And although it started to spread beyond London quite quickly through things like Alexei Sale touring and the comic strip touring and things like that, and also like Brighton had, clubs very, very early on, it took a while for it to percolate through the provinces, as you kind of suggested when you were talking about going to Newcastle and finding there was nothing there in terms of this type of entertainment. And what I think was interesting, I think Ross Noble talked about the kind of northeastern scene being like its own Galapagos Islands, where things evolved separately.
Yes.
But we felt the same about Birmingham, like Sheffield, where we were based. Manchester, that was a different scene again. And Bristol, I think, had a scene. What was really fascinating was, meeting Henry Normal, who was working in Manchester, and him telling us, because he was more established than us, here are good places to go and play. Meeting you guys up in Newcastle, inviting you to come down to come and do our gigs and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It was really interesting, like these separately evolved scenes making links. And so when we were invited to come and do Cabaret Go-Go at the Broken Doll, it was really interesting. And what we have here is the names of our... Well, we've got GLAAD, Soulful and Funky, but also we've got the three... There were more than three of us at this stage, but there were only three of us on the bill.
Yeah.
Because originally it was five members in our group.
Oh, okay.
So there was me... Oliver Double, that was the name I went under, even though a lot of people thought it was a stage name, it was actually my actual name. Roger Monkhouse, who I gave Roger that name, and he's still working today on the circuit.
That's right, yes.
Roger Shackle is his actual name, but he did we were throwing around the idea that maybe you should have a stage name, because, well, whatever, I'll get to that in a minute. And we were just throwing ideas around, and I went, Roger Monkhouse. And it was a really funny idea, because Bob Monkhouse was a famous sort of mainstream comedian.
That's right.
And one of Roger's very first routines was about how he was actually the bastard love child of Bob Monkhouse. And the first, and it says Bob's love child on there. Phil D. Rogers was actually called Phil Roberts, and for some reason he changed it to Phil D. Rogers. Mm-hmm. Phil was a gay comic who... He was quite different on stage and off. He was much more sort of... camp on stage and more poetic as well. He used to tell these kind of surreal stories about his encounters, gay encounters with Catholic priests and so on. But there was also a guy who was with us for a very short time, Mark Robinson, who used to do a kind of clowny act called Albert, but he never did any of the away gigs. He just did the few gigs with us in Sheffield. And he, I think, for many years he worked with Geese Theatre, he worked in prisons.
Okay.
And he may still be with them, I'm not sure. And the other act was Adam Cavallari.
I remember the name.
So Adam Cavallari's real name, Adam Shortland, and he's a medical physicist now. But he was a short guy who went prematurely bald, and he did a lot of very sad but funny jokes about being, unlucky in love, being bald, being short. There was a joke he told about... I was walking down the street the other day, because that's what comedians do. As I was walking, I was playing that game myself, if if I can reach that next lamppost before the next car, my life will be brilliant. I'll get the girl I want, I'll get that job. Sadly, things didn't work out quite that way. The lamppost fell on my head. That's why I'm shorter than advertised. It's a brilliant joke. But anyway, so on here you've got our little logo, which I drew, which is a kind of cartoon grape doing a left-wing communist fist salute at the top of a kind of imaginary, well, it looks like a beanstalk actually, but it's supposed to be a grapevine. And I remember that really well because I think Hufty was on as well. I think there were a bunch of acts on the poster. I know that Anvil was. And I remember talking to Martine about the small tits. And it was a very enjoyable event.
Wasn't this the gig where Roger was came under fire from a group of feminists in the audience who thought he was being sexist?
It sounds likely.
Yeah.
I think Roger liked to play at the idea of being offensive.
Yeah.
But actually not being offensive. But I think he liked to sort of wind up people by playing about with the idea that he might have said something bad, but actually it was always couched in such a way as to sort of have a kind of, that's not what he was actually saying. So it's very possible. It's very possible that somebody took umbrage at what something he said. I don't know.
We were quite, politically correct, I suppose the term is. But, you know, a lot of people were in those days.
Absolutely. Of course they were. Is that the last of the posters we got? Oh, look at that one. That's blue.
This is another one designed by me. And advertises a late bar, which is a really big deal in those days, you know. Excuse me. So we've got
Wireless, who we've seen before.
Yep, Big Fun Club again. Eric the Anarchist, who was a poet who was an anarchist, oddly enough. And his name's actually Mick Parkin.
Right. And he later went to the name Eric the Heretic.
That's right, yes.
And he became more of a sort of comic.
Yeah.
And then Ant Hill Runaways, which is an exciting new band.
Okay. Well, a little bit of information about the Ant Hill Runaways. Okay. First of all, they were kind of a country band, and I don't know if you remember Brianna Corrigan. She was lead singer of the Beautiful South.
Oh, amazing!
Yeah, so that was the band that she was in before she joined the Beautiful South.
Amazing!
Yeah.
And you're the host and compere.
Yes, and by this time, by this stage, I'd actually put transport information
to help people get there.
Yeah, because. Around the time that this poster was designed, I was taking flyers and posters all over Tyne and Wear. I was getting the message out there. So I go to the airport, I go to Sunderland, Tynemouth, South Shields, Gateshead, you name it, I got out there.
Because there weren't social media, right?
Exactly. There was no social media in those days, so you had to use Shanks's pony to get around. Oh, and the wonderful Tyne and Wear metro system.
Amazing. And this is very different in style from your other designs. In that, although there's still the same felt tip written lettering, you've also got a bit of kind of collage, I suspect, going on here. There's a guy in a who looks like a sort of, British Empire hunter or something.
Yeah.
And then a kind of picture of an old-fashioned camera that looks like it's a bit of old graphic art, maybe.
Yeah.
And then you've got these two characters over here who are kind of very stylized with long torsos and short legs, and it's a woman and a guy in looks like a tuxedo or something. They look like maybe flapper era, like 1920s. But also it's rendered in monotone still, but rather than black it's blue, which makes it look like an expensive poster for those days.
Yes, it does. And a little thing about the posters, they were not only seen as an act in their own right, but we saw them as kind of like a newspaper in a way. So it's interesting because every poster was designed completely differently, and people would actually look forward to the new poster.
That's brilliant, and collect them presumably.
Yes. Shall we move
on? Fantastic, yes.
Another one designed by me here.
This is a great design.
Yeah, and this one is quite an interesting one because there's an image here of a staircase with three faces in it. And the bottom face has, well, it's of a man, and he's got a hand there. And what I did was I'd taken a Cabaret Go-Go membership card, I'd cut it in two, and I'd sort of pasted it on.
So it looks like he's holding a membership card.
Yeah.
And the guy at the top, is that George Orwell?
I'm not sure.
It looks like it could be, though.
Yeah. I took this from either a magazine or a book, and I just thought, oh, that looks like an interesting picture. And as you can see, at the bottom right-hand corner is A Way of Life,
right,
which found its way onto loads of our posters. And
it's quite a nice slogan.
Yes.
Because it's kind of ambiguous and slightly artsy.
Yeah.
And the actor of Bridget Bard, she's well-armed.
Yeah, Bridget Bard was a poet, so we could get arts funding, Arts Council funding.
And it's presumably a punning name, because presumably it's supposed to be like Bridget Bardot, but Bridget Bard.
Exactly.
And then you've got Jez
and Spit and Sawdust, who are a juggling outfit, clowns. Jez. One Man in a Box, that was me.
Another pseudonym.
That was my street act persona.
Oh, brilliant.
And it was an act that involved, I didn't say very many words. I used very few words in this act. I had a load of cardboard boxes, and I had some juggling cigar boxes. I used to juggle cigar boxes and scarves. So that
I remember you juggling with scarves in your actual stand-up act.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I used those every now and again. This is an impression of me in a washing machine.
That's right, yeah, that's in the Buddy Hell stand-up act.
Yes.
And then what's this one?
Geet Raj was a band, I think. I'm pretty sure it was. Now, that name comes from two Geordie expressions that were never combined. So there was Geet, that's Geet Lushman, why yai, and Raj, that's Candy Raj-like. So those two words were combined.
So it's like, it's like Geordie squared.
Yeah. And Evil C was the host for that one.
Okay. That's great.
Yeah.
Oh, and then we've got another one here, which doesn't have any... This is the final one. This doesn't have any acts named. It just Cabaret Go-Go, Stranger Than Fiction.
Yeah.
And a kind of collage-y-looking thing with... Stars and Stripes, picture of Fred Astaire, small picture of Fred Astaire raising his top hat, and a kind of glamour girl, mid-20th century glamour girl in a swimsuit, sort of taking a hat off in a showbizzy kind of style, and it just says, Thursday, February the 18th, Broken Doll.
Yeah. Well, Bass wasn't very good on providing information, and he used to have a go at him all the time about this.
But it's a very fetching poster.
Yes, and this may have been either his penultimate or the last poster he actually designed, and he just sort of went off and did other things. So he designed the backdrops that we had as well. But not a lot of information. This would have been, 1988, actually.
So February 88.
Yeah, and I think the first 3 months of Cabaret Go-Go, we got hardly any punters.
Okay.
And I used to rip my hair out. I had more hair in those days. I was like, oh God, we should just give up. Oh, we're not getting an audience. And then one day, it could have been March, we turned up and there was a queue all the way down the street.
Cool. Good interview.
Thank you.
I want to know why they suddenly got all these audience members in March, what they did.
My sense was that like maybe, because I think my sense was from talking to Ray was that he was very concerned about, you know, not just playing to tiny crowds, that he put a lot of time into walking the streets and giving out flyers and whatever. And presumably that finally paid off. Who knows? I mean, you know, it's possible it could have been that on that bill, that particular night, there was an act that had a pre-existing following, like maybe a band or something. But I think the most likely thing is that just the all the hard work on publicity probably paid off.
So that was March 88 probably, because if it was set up in 87,
probably. I mean, I think he's right. I think we did play it in, I think it was 89 that we played it, and I remember the gig quite well, actually. I think it was an important early gig. I mean, it was important for us because we were based in Sheffield, and it was like these separate you know, it was like the Galapagos Islands, you know, I think, as I said, it was like being in these separate sort of evolutionary pools kind of thing, you know, that there was a scene in Manchester, there was a scene in Sheffield, scene up in Newcastle, scene in Birmingham. And so it's really cool to have exchange visits, as it were.
Yeah, it's interesting because you mentioned Nick Tokshek in that. Because I think it's in Linda's collection, but there's a double-sided A4 piece of paper by Nick Tokshek.
Yeah.
But it's listing lots of different alternative cabaret venues.
Yeah.
Kind of in London, but regionally as well. Like
yeah.
Cabaret Go-Go is included on that list. So it does seem like there was a little kind of community, really.
Definitely. It was also kind of interesting because the people who came up to play those provincial clubs weren't, I mean, they weren't all just local people at all by any means. Like, the only time I saw Maria Callas, who I mentioned in the interview, real name Maria McCurlane, who was, you know, quite a big name on the circuit in the late 80s. The only time I saw her live was at a gig. I can't remember where it was, but it was somewhere like Peterborough, because there was a regular venue there, but somewhere like that, or Leicester possibly. And a lot of them had those clubs. I mean, Spots in Nottingham, Spots with a Z. You know, so you had a thing where you got glimpses of how it's being done in London, which was sort of ahead of where we were in a way. But I remember I personally felt a little bit chip on the shouldery about that, and I also felt that there were, in some ways, we were. That, like, the provincial scene was more interesting than London, because I think perhaps by the time I arrived, those kind of weird cabaret acts like Hubert and Hilary Haddock had started maybe disappearing a bit more. They weren't quite so prevalent as they'd once been.
So it was more of it was becoming the comedy circuit.
Becoming more the comedy circuit, yeah. And whereas in the north, I mean, the people I remember were people like Henry Normal, comic poet, Kevin Cisse, a really fantastic kind of comic singer, sort of like a comic Billy Bragg, but, you know, a black comic Billy Bragg. His dad was from Sierra Leone, I think. And it was just a fantastic act. Not all his songs were funny. They were all great, though. And he was really funny in between as well. I mentioned him before in this podcast, but I'm a fan. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of the acts weren't straight stand-ups. So, the scene felt like it had a different twist. And I think each local scene probably had a slightly different feel as well.
I thought the subsidies thing that you picked up was also really interesting.
Yeah.
Because I've got, like, a collection entry here, which I wrote a while ago.
Yeah.
So it was good to remind myself of it. Because he talked about the Northern Arts Grant. They got an Arts Council grant as well. As well as some other kind of local support from the National Poetry Society and Time Slip, which was a comic shop in Newcastle.
Yeah, I mean, I may be wrong about this, but I think Time Slip used to be advertised in Viz Comic. They used to do these hilarious adverts, but they were for real, you know, local businesses. Side note, but there's a very, very funny one of those Viz adverts for a comic shop, may not have been Time Slip, and it has the thing from the Fantastic Four, the big, strong, rocky guy in trunks, punching somebody so hard that the upper body of the other person is covered with an impact star. And then the guy who's being hit has got a speech bubble that reads, "But surely that's a matter of opinion." Which I think is a really funny joke. But yeah, the funding issue is because, you know, it was really part of alternative comedy's ethos in a way, to an extent, that it was driven by people wanting to come and watch it. Therefore, it was purely market orientated, even though it was a left-wing scene. But that's not the whole truth. It just isn't. There were various examples of funding being given. Also, it still appears as a debate in newspapers, you know, in recent years, that the Arts Council has refused to fund things on the grounds that they're comedy before. So that's a very interesting area, you're right.
Mm.
But of course, this podcast isn't just about us talking to each other or telling you things, it's also about you getting involved.
Get involved!
There are various ways that you can get involved in this podcast, but first you'll need to know how to contact us. You can email us via standup@kent.ac.uk. That's standup, all one word, no hyphen, at kent.ac.uk. Or you can find us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @histcompod.
So the first way you can get involved is go to the online catalogue for the Stand Up Comedy Archive, find a listing for a comedy object and nominate it. We'll talk about all nominated objects in future episodes. That's the vanilla version of getting involved.
The chocolate chip version of getting involved is to come and visit the British Stand Up Comedy Archive in the Templeman Library at the University of Kent. If you record a short piece about the object that you've seen, send us the audio and we'll feature it in a future episode.
And the stupidest way of getting involved, let's call it the tutti frutti way, is to record your own cover version of our theme tune for the podcast. Send it to us, and if we like it, we'll feature it in a future episode. Just to let you know, if you do get involved, we will give you rewards like podcast badges, British Stand Up Comedy Archive t-shirts, and that kind of pizzazz, if that's a word. It is now.
A History of Comedy in Several Objects is devised and presented by Dr. Oliver Double and Elspeth Miller for the British Stand Up Comedy Archive, brought to you by the University of Kent. This is made possible by the University of Kent's Public Engagement Research Fund. Photography by Matt Wilson, and editing and production by Matt Hulse.